Hi, I'm Sam Seder. This week on Ring of Fire, legal expert Scott Lemieux will join us to discuss the implications of Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court and the role the court may play in this election and the ones to come. And Heather Digby Parton will help me run through another crazy week in news as we draw closer to Election Day. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor. Become a member and support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. Now here to break down this week in the news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, here we are. It is, at the very least, it's, I suspect we will know the winner of the election by the time we speak again. I suspect it's not definitive, but we are now just a couple of days away from the end of the voting period. The length of the counting period in states like Pennsylvania and North Carolina is still, it seems to be in question. The Supreme Court this week allowed them to at least maintain the rules of them counting the ballots as long as they arrive or postmarked by Election Day. But that is subject to change. The Supreme Court can do essentially, it appears, what it wants in this regard. So this has been a long 4 years. Let's hope that it's not another horrifically long 4 years. We should talk about the sort of, I guess, the closing arguments for the candidates. And also, it just so happens we have a new Supreme Court justice this week, one who is very likely to provide the fifth vote. It's a 6-3 majority now for conservatives. But in some instances, we have John Roberts seems to be a little bit concerned about his legacy. And but I feel that she will provide the fifth vote over the coming years to curb, if not completely reverse, a woman's federal right, constitutional right to have sovereignty over her body. She will provide for huge carve-outs for religious people to not follow our laws in this country if they deem it to be contrary to their religion. I suspect we will also see the diminution of the power of agencies to regulate things like water and air and food safety and consumer safety and workers' safety and workers' rights. I think we will see a whole host of these things in the coming years. I think it will curb our ability as a society to provide health care to people, frankly, and more, unless we end up seeing a court expanded. Let's save that topic for another day. But one of the things that came out of this, you know, and before we get to the election, is that Mitch McConnell is prancing around, patting himself on the shoulder. And in many respects, he deserves it. He has fundamentally altered the nature of our federal courts, probably for generations.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and he is prancing around taking credit for it. In fact, you know, that it's in one respect, this is one way that Trumpism has really taken over the entire Republican Party, in which they brag, you know, constantly about themselves in ways that I think in the past they would have said, oh, no, you know, this was a team effort or whatever, or, you know. But now, you know, he's just out there saying no one since LBJ,
yep,
as majority leader has had this much effect on our nation for generations to come. I mean, he's really very proud of himself. And you're absolutely right. It is true that it took a ruthless, well, as he calls himself, the Grim Reaper, a ruthless, partisan, power mad, kind of leader in order to do what he has done. I mean, you have to be completely shameless and totally focused on achieving a goal that you cannot do legitimately, and be willing to go out there. And he says this too. He says, "Yeah, you know, I mean, people call me names, and I don't care. This is a job. This is what we do, and you got to be ready for it." So you need somebody like that, and they had it in Mitch McConnell. And evidently, he's been, you know, plotting this since he worked on, you know, under Nixon back in the 1970s. This has been his personal project, his great, you know, white whale, and he finally killed it. And, you know, the one thing I think people should remember, and not getting into any of the details, is that, you know, this idea that we were counting on Justice John Roberts to get us through this and somehow be our great savior in all of these things because he was concerned about the legitimacy of the court, I think was probably a mistake. I mean, he did rule in some cases. I'm sure he is concerned about the legitimacy of the court, but he's far to the right of the last right-wing swing justice, who was Anthony Kennedy. So, you know, the real crime in this was stealing that Merrick Garland seat, mm-hmm. rather than Amy Coney Barrett being put on it. That was the original sin of Mitch McConnell. And once that happened, we were always going to be in trouble. So, you know, we needed to be, I say we, Democrats, people who care about the country, needed to be thinking about how to fix this ongoing problem that we have, in which this minority of the country, the Republicans, are able to have this massively overrepresented influence on the government. I mean, something very fundamental is askew here that has to be fixed, and it needed to be fixed regardless of Amy Coney Barrett. And
correct.
You know, McConnell said that. In his comments, he said, you know, they were going to do this anyway. So I would hope so. I mean, Amy, this seems to have focused the minds of the Democrats, but it was always a problem. This is something that has to be dealt with, whether it's in terms of representation in the Senate or on the court or whatever. This is a fundamental problem here. And, you know, at its heart is white supremacy. And a bunch of people just saying that we're going to use whatever power we have, and they have a lot of it, to prevent the new multiracial, multiethnic America from, you know, seizing the power that they're due as a majority. So, you know, we've got our work cut out for us, and we would have had our work cut out for us anyway, regardless of Amy Coney Barrett. I guess that's what I'm saying.
That's right. And let me just add to that, too, one other element, is that this is not just a question of, although it may be, frankly, in my mind, sufficient to make it a question of, you know, political preference, right? I mean, we're in a pitched political battle here. So there's sort of two lenses you can look at it, that this is from a, you know, center left perspective and everything that entails in terms of the way that we want the country to look at. But you could also look at it from a completely non-ideological perspective, which is to simply say from a function of democracy. I mean,
right.
We have the Senate. We have had a Senate being ruled by a party that has garnered significantly less than 50% of the vote in the Senate. I mean, in terms of senators, we have a president who garnered not just less than 50%, but lost the plurality of the vote as well. Right. I mean, we've had presidents who have won with less than 50% of the vote before, but we've now had our two last Republican presidents, both of their first terms were with a lack of a plurality of the vote, and the Supreme Court is dominated by conservatives, even though you have something like the Democrats winning, like I said, six I think it is of the seven or eight of the last nine plebiscites in terms of who won the majority of votes. I mean, so there is a fundamental problem both from, you know, an ideological partisan standpoint in terms of we're in a war, a political war, and we obviously feel that our side represents better values. But there's also just a fundamental disconnect from any concept of democracy. And that makes it even that much more unsustainable unless there is some balance that is brought about. And the adherence to arcane Senate, you know, rules and decorum that the Democrats have practiced have in many respects led us into this hole. I mean, Patrick Leahy upheld every single blue slip. Yep. And more so, and allowed the Republicans to quash dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds, of federal judges, which left all of this open and ripe for Mitch McConnell, and he took advantage of it. And they have filled the federal judiciary, and he's right. I mean, I think as much as I loathe Mitch McConnell, and as much as I think the Democrats have been, if not willing accomplices, have been inept defenders of the Democratic Party in allowing Mitch McConnell to have this type of outsized impact, and both in terms of like the depth of the impact and the sort of the temporal scope of it. I mean, we're going to be living with these things for a long time unless the Democrats react to it. And so that is, you know, that is the legacy, at least as it stands before the election. Of course, if Donald Trump wins or the Republicans retain the Senate, you know, I don't even know how to really contemplate that scenario. And maybe that's something we should just like, let's not go there and deal with it if it happens next week. But we got to look towards what happens if Joe Biden wins. And you've written a great piece on this this week in Salon, and I want to get to it in a moment. But let's just briefly talk about what the closing arguments are for the respective candidates. Donald Trump seems to be, we should not count every vote. That's the his closing argument. And Joe Biden is, I'm not Donald Trump. And that's basically where we're at.
Well, that's right. And you and I have talked about this before. You know, it's rogue president, not rogue president.
Right.
And it doesn't, you know, this is just, this is where the country is. And I think that, you know, I mean, we're seeing things in this election so far, and, you know, who knows how it's going to shake out in the end. But, you know, like a tremendous youth vote. And that's not, that was completely unexpected, I think, because, you know, traditionally younger voters tend to tune out and don't necessarily come out and vote. They've got better things to do and they're living their lives. And when they do come out, it's usually because of some charismatic leader like Obama. They came out pretty big for Obama, and he was a very exciting and youthful kind of candidate that got a lot of people excited. This is not that.
Let me just add to that,
that you get this big youth turnout for this ticket. But it seems clear that, you know, rogue, not rogue, is compelling to people, even those who maybe traditionally might have tuned out the election because there wasn't anything exciting for them to vote for in this, other than maybe, you know, like saving the world, saving the country, restoring democracy, you know, these sort of abstract kind of ideas that Donald Trump sort of brought to the fore. And I think that, you know, this is an interesting lesson for Democrats because we've always depended on the, you know, well, they, you know, they're the haters, we're the lovers, they go high, we, you know, they go low, we go high, you know, this kind of inspirational thing. And, you know, it is, it's great. It's, you want to have that kind of feeling. But I think Democrats have never really taken advantage of the fact that, you know, electorally anyway, they haven't been willing to sort of, you know, make the most of the fact that we have this rogue party. And it's not just Donald Trump. It's the entire Republican and conservative movement project that's been going on for a long time. You and I have talked about this endlessly, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it further because this is not going away. And you know, it took Donald Trump, you know, this crude, sort of blatantly roguish president who is totally incompetent and ignorant and just sort of let the whole thing hang out, for Democrats to recognize that, you know, people needed to see it. They needed to understand what they were up against, that there was a burgeoning sort of, you know, in order to understand something as fundamental as wealth inequality, something that Democrats care about on a values level, on a fundamental level, in order to illustrate that, you've got to show what the other side is doing, and you needed to be able to do that. And, you know, in that sense, I think for the first time, I feel like the Democratic Party has been radicalized in a necessary way by Donald Trump. He didn't invent this stuff. It was there. Donald Trump was the Republican Party's tool as much as anything to get what they wanted over the last 4 years. And that it seems to be that this was what it took to get Democrats through. I mean, you hear people like Chris Coons, you know, we've talked about him.
Well,
too. You know, he's Mr. Middle of the Road, moderate, let's see, institutionalist and all that. And he sounded downright like AOC on TV last week after the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation. And I guess that's what it took. I mean, they had to have it rubbed in their faces in order to get it done. So, let's hope it sticks.
All right. Well,
don't forget.
Let me catch up to you here because, and I want to, you know, I just wind my way up there because I am not convinced that what Chris Coons is saying is how he's going to behave in weeks to come, which gets to your piece, but in a second, but yes, I just want to reiterate your point about the youth vote, and we're seeing already as of by the time people hear this, it is quite likely that there will have already been more early votes in Texas than there were votes in Texas in 2016. That even before Election Day, as of like Thursday of this week or Wednesday of this week, I think we were at like 94% of the vote tally of 2016 already. And youth vote, like you say, is, to the extent that we can tell, seems to be enormous. And I think, you know, it has been a classic mantra truism that you will not get the youth vote out under any circumstances. You had a one-off essentially with Barack Obama in 2008, who not only was charismatic and young, but was represented the opportunity for the first black president. And I think people projected onto that a whole host of changes, of societal changes that, exceeded what he delivered as a president and what he delivered in terms of policy. And the irony, like you say, is that, you know, Joe Biden at best is offering like, you know, I'm going to go back to where we were. and so, you know, the change is just like going to be like, I'm going to change back to normal. And I'm not convinced that that is why the youth turnout is there. I think the youth turnout is there because they want a substantive change and are going and are practical enough to realize like this is our one vehicle to do it. I think the shift is that. And I say this, you know, in retrospect and maybe a little bit jaded, and I know that maybe you have some of this too in terms of the Obama administration. Obama was using that energy. And I think this time around, that energy is using Joe Biden. And it is a, you know, it's a slightly subtle distinction, but Obama, I think there was this sense, Obama, you know, famously said going into the 2010 election, I got this. And in fact, he didn't have it. I think there is the idea that Joe Biden would say to anybody, I got this. Everybody would be like, no, you don't. We've got this. And you're coming along for the ride. And I think that's a very important distinction. And I think I'm not convinced that, you know, when we say Democrats, right, like it's like, who are we talking about? I am not convinced that the leadership of the Democratic Party has quite gotten it yet. I mean, I'm not convinced that we're going to have to wait and see. But, you know, we see things like Dianne Feinstein at the end of the Coney Barrett hearings praising Lindsey Graham. I mean, that is a, I think what we're dealing here with is a major generational divide. And when we see the youth vote come out, I think it's indicative of that. I think there is a complete sea change in our politics that is happening. And we are seeing, we haven't seen the wave crest. We are seeing the wave build, and if it has the opportunity to sweep Donald Trump out of office, I think that wave is going to create a tremendous amount of pressure, and I think I hope I do on the elected Democrats, because I do think that you're right, and so to the extent that there is, and this has been building for a while, your rank and file Democrat, I think, has become, you can see this in the polling, less interested in things like compromise. Less, I think you would hear less people say, like, well, the Republicans will take care of Donald Trump. You know, we don't have to worry about that. I think there is an awareness is that, you know, the party has been this. I mean, today I read a piece that there was a former head of the Federal Election Commission who was appointed, I think it was by George W. Bush. And he's now part of a group that is, you know, protecting the vote. And there's a quote in there that says something to the effect of, like, I never thought that I would see Republicans trying to suppress the vote. And I was just like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Like, it's beyond laughable. I mean, I've got, you know, we can go look at Richard Viguerie. I mean, excuse me, Paul Weyrich, who was addressing Republicans in 1980. And there's a video. People can go Google it. And it's like, you Christians, because he's talking to his fellow Christians, you know, and your goo-goo government, you want people to vote? I don't want people to vote. The less people that vote, the more leverage it gives us. And this is a guy who went on to found the Heritage Foundation, to found or co-found the American Legislative Exchange Council, to coin the phrase moral majority. I mean, this is literally one of the founding fathers of the modern day conservative movement and Republican Party. And he was stating first principles in 1980 publicly. We want to suppress the vote. And they have taken this to an art form that involves every single mechanism of our government to do so. The post office, the Supreme Court, the state courts, the state legislatures. I mean, every facet of our government that they have been able to gain control over has been used to suppress the vote. The court to reverse the Voting Rights Act. I mean, just on and on and on. They have deployed everything. Technology, I mean, you know, Secretary of States. And this has been going on. It happened in 2000 as well. It just was the second story, right? The first story was how the Supreme Court just, you know, basically handed George W. Bush the presidency. But I mean, there's still, and even the idea that someone could write that article. I don't even know where it was. It was the New York Times or Politico. I mean, like, the idea that someone could write that article and actually take that at face value, as opposed to, like, you know, laugh line, you know, is still, I think, a fundamental problem in the understanding our society has of the role the Republican Party has been playing in our country.
No kidding. And this particular one, this sort of, you know, this denigration, this degradation of democracy, this is, you know, this has been going on for, you know, since the beginning, really. If you look at, you know, going Jim Crow in the South, you know, you go back to, you know, suffrage for women. I mean, this just goes on and on and on of them, you know, of our so-called democracy not being a real democracy. But this modern version of it that you're talking about, I mean, and it does, this even goes back to the 60s. I mean, we had a Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, who, when he was confirmed as a Supreme Court Justice, they brought up that back in the 60s, he'd been part of something called Operation Eagle Eye, which was he was from Arizona, and he was standing outside intimidating people who looked like they might be Latino into not voting. I mean, this has been going on since from the 60s. The Chief Justice. Now we have three Supreme Court justices on the current court who were part of Bush versus Gore, who argued that they should stop counting votes, which is essentially what the Supreme Court did. They came up with an insane rationale saying that if you count all the votes, you might disenfranchise people whose votes had already been counted. I mean, it's enough to make your head explode. So this, what you're saying is absolutely true, and I've been writing about this for a long time. I mean, one of the things that they did, and I won't belabor this, but back in the 1980s when Jesse Jackson's campaign took off, and, you know, it scared the hell out of Republicans because he was activating a group of people, African-Americans, many of them in urban areas, who hadn't been voting. And suddenly they were voting, and they were voting in the South, and Jesse Jackson won a bunch of
primaries.
Of primaries in 2004 and 2008. And they got scared, and they created this group called the Republican National Lawyers Association, which are devoted to suppressing votes all over the country. They work with states and Republican legislatures. And they're the ones who are out there right now that are waiting in all these states, prepared. They're just sitting there waiting for the opportunity to go and challenge votes, to deploy whatever kind of, you know, legal methods they have to bring cases in the hopes that they can basically throw out as many votes as possible. That's since the 1980s. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time. The idea that suddenly everybody's waking up and going, gosh, you know, they're really trying to suppress the votes. It's only because they've got Donald Trump out there basically, you know, saying the quiet part out loud. He's just saying it, you know, but they've been doing it this whole time. I mean, and this just goes to our ongoing conversation about this, that this isn't a Donald Trump problem. This is a conservative movement problem.
Right.
It's a right-wing problem. It's an impending fascism problem. And honestly, I think, you know, we're just getting back to the youth vote. You know, when you see people, I mean, this is the 18 to 29-year-olds, by the way, that we're talking about. This is the youngest of the millennials and the oldest group of Generation Z. They're young. I mean, this isn't like, oh, you know, they're all 40. I mean, these are young people who are coming out to vote in large numbers, and they are doing this. I agree with you completely. This is because they're seeing, you know, they have substantive reasons for doing this. It isn't, oh, Donald Trump is icky. As far as they're concerned, I mean, for some of them, he's the only president that they've really been aware of for
right.
The youngest, right? I mean, they're just kind of going, wow, you know, that's not it for them. What it is, you know, you've got people, the Parkland kids and gun safety. You've got Greta Thunberg. You've got Black Lives Matter. You've got an entire array of issues and causes and movements that are going to Sunrise Movement and climate. You've got these causes that are there that they see their entire future is sort of going to go up in smoke unless they take possession of the system in a way that, you know, they can wrest it from this what they very clearly see. It's not just, you know, it's sort of, there's sort of a moribund political establishment, but I think they are actually very clearly seeing that this is a pitched battle between people like, you know, Mitch McConnell, older generation people, you know, and it's not just that they're old, it's that they're evil. And
right.
I think that they really see this. And as a result, you know, I mean, what we're seeing is, and this is something I've been so impressed about with Gen Z anyway, and the kids in Parkland and whatever, is that they have this cross between idealism and pragmatism, where they see both sides of it. You've got the Parkland kids out there, you know, David Hogg and those guys. They're out there, you know, saying vote. You know, they're talking about voting, but they're also in the streets. And you have to have, that's the sort of thrust of my piece that you were talking about, that, you know, this is what has to happen. You've got to have both of those things going on. And I'm seeing for the first time really ever in my life that we're seeing that combination of pragmatism, idealism, inside, outside, progressivism, that is absolutely going to be necessary. You can't do it with one or the other. You can't just do Occupy and have, you know, people say, we're not here to deal with the corrupt political system because state power is too important.
That's right.
Is way, way, way too important. You can't leave that on the table. You will fail. Because it's usually, so you have to, so you've got, in this case now, we've got like, you know, there's AOC in the House. You've got that whole group of young progressives that are coming up. You've got a slightly, perhaps more flexible, you know, sort of establishment that maybe Donald Trump finally knocks some sense into them. And then you've got these young people out in the streets, you know, making a statement, not allowing anybody to tell them that they can't do it. And maybe we've got a population that's looking at, after this whole, you know, business with Trump and the Republicans over the last few years, things like Iraq, you know, all of this, the trauma that we've been through for the last 25 years. Maybe there's an actual American population that's finally saying, enough, okay, we've got to change this because, this has gone wrong. I mean, that sounds maybe overly optimistic. I don't even know.
Well, I'm going to give you three out of four on that one. I am skeptical about the leadership of the Democratic Party, but I will say this. It literally, they're on the clock, right? I mean, when we're looking
right.
at a generation of people who are, I don't even know if they're, you know, some of these are not boomers. They're like silent generation.
Most of them are.
Yeah.
I mean, Pelosi, Feinstein, Leahy, this group of people are, you know, they're in their 80s.
Yep.
I mean, this isn't, they aren't even baby boomers.
Yep. And you know, I mean, I think... The reality is that let's put it this way, the number of I had calculated this the other day. I think maybe I'd mentioned it on the show a couple of weeks ago. But when you think about how many leaders of the Republicans in the House we have seen just since Nancy Pelosi has taken the realm, right? I mean, maybe half a dozen. Under the time that Nancy Pelosi has been the only leader of the party's leadership, I think is sclerotic, and it has been far too static, and it has, frankly, I think, too much power within the context of the party. You know, I mean, we were talking about the problem with democracy in the context of our government, And frankly, I just think that, you know, and we were talking about this some time ago, I would much rather see a leader in the House, a Democratic leader in the House, whose ideology I don't particularly agree with, but has less of a hold on the caucus.
Right.
Because,
right.
I mean, frankly, you know, and I understand, well, I don't understand the reasoning for why Nancy Pelosi... Soon as if $1.8 trillion, you know, not necessarily appropriated in all the places you want it to be at all, maybe only, you know, a half of it is what you could agree on, maybe even a quarter of it. You say yes, you get the money spent because you're banking on the Democrats winning anyways. If they don't win, then you're not going to be part of the equation, you know, going forward, you know, after the election. But they were afraid of doing anything that could be perceived as a victory for Donald Trump, which I find hard to believe. I really do think it was really just a function of Nancy Pelosi wanting to maintain her power as leader of the Democrats, and by not selling out her committee chairs. Like, she had a constituency, and she was serving that constituency, and it was not us. It was the people who were going to make sure that she becomes the majority leader. Chuck Schumer, when Dianne Feinstein holds that hearing, I mean, they shouldn't have held the hearing in the first place. Never mind Dianne Feinstein going in there and praising Lindsey Graham to the detriment of Jamie Harrison. That is a function of Chuck Schumer perceiving the other senators as his constituents, and that he's basically there to provide constituent services as opposed to being a leader. And saying, I'm not going to do this job if we can't move in some certain specific directions. My job is not just to cater to you so that you keep me in power. My job is to, in some days, you know, get on your nerves and force you to do stuff that you don't necessarily want to do because it's better for everybody. And I am not seeing that at all from the Democrats. I mean, look, Mitch McConnell. You and I think he's an evil person, and I would argue that until the day, you know, a day I turn blue, but and he certainly is power hungry. But let's be clear, he did this in service of an ideology. I mean, what he's done is extraordinary. It is going to, if we are lucky, it's going to force the Democrats to expand the size of the court for the first time in a century. More. And that is because his ideological agenda was bigger than even himself. And we need to start having leaders like that. we need to start having leaders like that on the center left, where people are, they have an agenda and their aspirations are secondary to that agenda. And that agenda, you know, that's what we're going to need to get out of this mess. But I also do think that, frankly, you and I are going to be watching from the sidelines as a whole new generation. Because I do think so much of this is generational, that we finally have a generation that is big in size as the boomers, who have been in many respects and even the, I guess, the silent generation, who provided sort of a, you know, quite a shadow that inhibited the growth of, you know, I think certainly of like Gen X and maybe, you know, the late boomers. And this is a generation that I think is going to have like the sort of the civic and, you know, cultural power that is going, you know, they're going to define themselves in a way that I think prior generations have not, you know, having the ability to define themselves. And I'm encouraged by it.
Oh, I am too. And I'm quite enthusiastic about what I see coming from this group, which is, you know, and then this was sort of the piece that I wrote was kind of in response to someone else who'd written in Salon, you know, about the outside movements that were, you know, basically, you know, more important or more necessary, the you know, kind of direct action, which he was arguing for. You've got to do direct action. That is how you make change. And I agree with that. You have to have that. That is an element that is far too important. And, you know, the right wing knows that, too. They've done that as well. So they understand how that works. Especially in the modern sort of, you know, era of modern communications, where, you know, these images that go out to all of us that we see, that they make, I think they have a big impact. If you look at the Black Lives Matter protests from the summer, I think that a lot of us older people probably would have assumed that that was not going to be well received by the American people. To see a bunch of people in the streets, a bunch of young people screaming, tear gas and all that, it was kind of, you know, but that's our own youthful trauma, right? That is not how people saw it this time. Even older people didn't see it that way. And so things have changed. And the way that people perceive that kind of, you know, massive kind of people power, I think it has a different kind of, you know, it creates a different reaction in the population. And I think that so you need that. You've got to have that direct action. But I also, and I don't mean to reiterate this, but I just think it's so important that you can't leave state power on the table. You have to have that as well. It is way, 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 there's much too much influence on our everyday life from the things that those people in Washington do, the things that, you know, like, I mean, why do we even have a court where they wear robes and stuff? I mean, it's just kind of, you know, weird antediluvian kind of ritualistic nonsense that we have that, but it's there and we're not going to get rid of it. It's part of what our, you know, our whole system is built upon. You can't just look at it and go, oh, that's some old, you know, stuff that doesn't matter, because it actually, I mean, unless you're just, you know, a revolutionary. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, a new civil war or something, you're in a different plane than I am. But I'm just assuming that, you know, because we're facing existential problems, like, you know, I mean, climate change alone is just, that could devote, you could devote every bit of government energy into trying to fix that problem. But, you know, you've got worldwide problems. We live on a planet with a bunch of other people, and a lot of them are doing things that are going to affect our lives. And you can't leave that. You have to deal with that and deal with it, you know, with practical commitment.
Yep.
And so I'm really enthusiastic about the idea that that youth, I look at AOC and her crowd in the progressive end of the house. And I'm tremendously impressed by the way that they have handled all of this. I mean, including this election, by the way. None of them are looking at Joe Biden as, you know, somebody that they just would have, you know, he's not their dream candidate, let's put it that way, or yours or mine. But they recognized in a practical way that this was what we're dealing with. And it's just like AOC said the other day, they were talking about, I don't know if it was the Green New Deal or one of the issues that she has disagreements with, you know, the Biden campaign with. And she said, I very much look forward to exercising my privilege to lobby them. And I thought, wow, you know, she is just so, you know, she's so smart. That's the exactly the way to say it in this moment, right?
Yep.
I mean, we're getting ready to vote here. So this is how you put it. This is how she speaks to her constituency, which I think is this youth movement. I think that's what we're talking about.
Well, Heather, that seems like a good place to end it on a very hopeful note. I just want to, you know, if anybody has their absentee ballot with them, don't mail it. If you're hearing the sound of my voice at this point, it's too late to mail that ballot. You go drop it off. Drop it off at an early polling place. Drop it off at a drop box. Drop it off at your board of electors. But drop off that ballot if you want it to be counted. Because even in some places where they're supposedly counting later, you just don't know with what's going on. So the next time we speak, at the very least, the voting will be closed. And hopefully it'll be have been counted. And we can continue this conversation about how we will push the Democratic Party and how we will achieve these goals, hopefully. Could be we're talking about how we're dealing with the outcome or non-outcome of the election. We shall see. It is crunch time. I cannot believe it is upon us. But
I can't wait.
I cannot wait either.
I'm anxious for this to be over.
Me too. But I'm so happy to have the opportunity to talk to you about it, as always. Thank you so much,
Heather.
Thanks
for having me.
This week was a pretty big week in terms of legal news. Joining me now to discuss a couple of huge legal ramifications, including what the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation means for the Supreme Court and the country, Scott Lemieux from the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money. So, Scott, it's been quite a week in the Supreme Court, and it has been quite a week in the Supreme Court. I mean, the case in Wisconsin alone would be enough to warrant our conversation. It also just so happens that the court now has a 6-3 majority conservative majority, and the implications, all of these things are, these are not coincidental in many respects, and they are not or not just coincidental. Let's put it that way. Let's start with this big case. I think everyone is aware that Amy Coney Barrett is now a member of the Supreme Court. I think everybody is aware of how it is that she got there, including, you know, what happened 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago now, almost, when Mitch McConnell held open the seat that Merrick Garland was nominated for. And of course, Mitch McConnell couldn't help himself this week, got extremely giddy, and was comparing himself to LBJ in LBJ's role as the Senate Majority Leader. And frankly, probably with some reason, too, in terms of the way that he's been able to fundamentally change the federal judicial system in this country. But let's talk specifically about the Wisconsin case. Explain to me what it was and why the outcome was not necessarily surprising, but Brett Kavanaugh's, I guess, affirmation was in some ways disturbing.
Yeah, so I think that if this had just been a case where, you know, the Supreme Court just, you know, let, you know, the lower court order stand, maybe a brief dissent by Sotomayor or Kagan, you know, I would have been disappointed, but, you know, everybody expects that. I mean, when cases get to the Supreme Court, voters lose. So the case was just, you know, a district court judge had issued a very careful opinion pointing out that because the typical first class letter in Wisconsin is taking 7 days to arrive, and incidentally, that's not just something that happened, that's, you know, deliberate Republican sabotage, that the, you know, deadline should be extended, essentially the Wisconsin legislature was disenfranchising voters, that any ballot received up to three days after the election should be counted. So again, any lower court, I should say that for five of the Supreme Court justices that were on the court before Monday, you know, any federal court intervention was going to be struck down. Chief Justice Roberts is different in that he will at least allow state courts to interpret their state's own laws to extend deadlines, but not federal courts. So, you know, there was no way that, you know, unfortunately, there was no way this is going to stand. You know, and I think that, you know, Democrats have done a reasonably good job of educating their voters that, you know, if the ballots weren't in the mail by Monday, drop them off or vote in person. So, you know, again, it's unfortunate, but that would have been okay.
All right, Steve, Scott, one second. I want to just make sure that people are caught up with what the issues were here, at least. You say now five justices, then it would have been four justices who believe that a federal court, this is the district court, does not have the right to overrule essentially what the legislature in the state has set for voting rules. And then you said, and I think that's fairly straightforward. People can understand that. But there are at least four and perhaps five now Supreme Court justices, excluding that to the exclusion of John Roberts is excluding that now would argue perhaps that a state court, even the state Supreme Court of Wisconsin, let's say, could not adjudicate or change in any way the voting requirements in light of a pandemic, that it must come from the legislature.
Right. So that's where the Pennsylvania right now still has its 3-day extension because Chief Justice Roberts has been consistent in saying that, you know, if a state court is interpreting state law, there's no federal question, so he won't intervene. And to his credit, he has at least been, you know, and it's really shocking to think that the author of Shelby County actually has people to his right on voting rights. You know, we don't technically know Coney Barrett's position on that. And even if, you know, it could be that they just decide strategically, you know, certainly if I were Coney Barrett, I would not want to issue an opinion, you know, throwing out a state court's decisions to help Donald Trump before I was on the court for a week. But, you know, these justices aren't necessarily strategic thinkers or very subtle. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But on whenever a federal court has intervened, Roberts has just been on the same page as anybody else. So that pretty much made the decision in the Wisconsin case overdetermined. The really disturbing thing was, you know, and I don't know whether this was provoked by the very, very strong dissent filed by Elena Kagan, but, you know, both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh wrote fairly lengthy concurrences. The Gorsuch one was just kind of annoying, but, you know, basically – Kavanaugh's, it wasn't so much a judicial opinion as like a daily caller call, you know, in the form of you know, if you go to Slate or some other sites, it's just riddled with, you know, just obvious howlers and, you know, willful misunderstandings of election law. It's just embarrassing. But the most disturbing part of it is that Kavanaugh claims, and Trump echoed this once again today, that states have an interest in declaring a winner on Election Day. Now, that's completely false, and Kagan pointed that out in a footnote that, you know, in fact, Kavanaugh actually said that it undermines the integrity of the electoral process if results flip after Election Day. And as Kagan points out, results, you know, if you're counting legally cast ballots, the results aren't flipping. That's just the result. There's no flipping. Nobody is entitled to be declared the winner because they're ahead on at midnight on Election Day. It's just outrageous.
I just want to sit here and let this marinate for a second at what the Supreme Court justice said. The implication is you get all these legally cast votes, right? I mean, we got to make sure that people aren't conflating the question of like, and there's a whole host of ways in which the court now has aided and abetted the narrowing of what constitutes legal votes, right? They have narrowed it by, in some cases, rolling back the Voting Rights Act and allowing states to make all sorts of requirements about voter ID, et cetera, or narrowed the times in which you can vote. And in that Wisconsin case, they have narrowed the time in which the vote can arrive, even if it's been mailed on Election Day. But this has nothing to do with that. When he talks about flipped, he is talking about all of the narrowing we have done in terms of what constitutes a legally cast and an eligible vote to be counted. He is adding the notion that somehow votes that the vote counters themselves still have in a pack, in a stack next to their table, essentially, as they're counting. If it hits 1201 on November 3rd, then those votes, for whatever reason, don't count because they haven't been counted yet. I mean, it's just bizarre. I mean, and it's contrary to every single election we've had. Of course, they count all the votes.
Yeah, and as Abby Phillip of the Washington Post points out, like, no, nobody's declared the winner on election day. You know, that's like, networks can make declarations based on projections or whatever, but states themselves are not obligated to declare a winner on election day and almost never do. You know, they have weeks to certify results. And of course, nobody knows that better than Brett Kavanaugh, who spent November 2000 arguing that courts should add, you know, military ballots that didn't even meet technical standards, you know, as late as Thanksgiving. So, you know, he's not, you know, although, you know, he's a very mediocre intellect, you know, he's not that dumb. He's just lying on behalf of the president who appointed him. It's really outrageous stuff. And it's even more outrageous in context because Kavanaugh claims that, you know, the deadline couldn't be extended because states, you know, Wisconsin had a powerful interest in having to count over on election day, except that Republicans in both Wisconsin and Pennsylvania are refusing to allow counties to start counting ballots before election day. So even in Florida, which is not exactly a haven of voting rights, most people vote by mail, and they actually start to count those ballots in advance so there can be a timely, announcement on election night. But that's what Democrats want in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. The Republicans there are not allowing it. So it's even more nefarious in context, which is clearly that the strategy is, you know, they don't think they can win. But because Trump is encouraging his voters to vote in person, essentially they're hoping that Trump can be ahead in one or both of those states and then just declare victory on the third and have, a bunch of Republican judges start shutting down counts and throwing out ballots. It's legitimately shocking for an associate justice in the United States to, you know, sort of that dishonestly essentially come out in favor of an open electoral theft scheme. That's being now repeated by the president again.
Okay. And so, all right. So, but that would be, that would be just sort of a side note, I guess, because like you say, you didn't, there was not the Wisconsin ruling in and of itself was not particularly, surprising. So what are the implications of both this idea that, maybe there the quality or the validity of a vote is a function of how quickly it can be counted, even if it's cast perfectly by the voter. What are the implications of that? Also, what are the implications of the notion that a state Supreme Court or a state court can be overruled by a federal court in supposed deference to legislatures? And let me just add one sort of also point that I'd like you to just discuss, or I may exhaust the point, is that the argument is, right, that this deference to state legislatures, the reason why we have that is because they can be held to account by the voter. It's pretty ironic to say that when you're talking about Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, two states which have a marked history or recent history since the gerrymandering of getting more Democratic votes, over 50% Democratic votes and significantly less 50% representation in these state houses. I mean, that's some real, to speak to that, but also to the implications of all of this in terms of like what could be on election day.
Yeah, I mean, Gorsuch's concurrence wasn't as bad, but it was basically this incredibly smarmy civics lesson about how, well, you know, the democratic process is inefficient, but legislatures can be held accountable, and that's where the power should go. When, of course, you know, a majority of Wisconsinites want to be governed by Democrats, but Democrats have only about a third of the seats in the legislature because Wisconsin has gerrymandered the legislature so that it's almost impossible for Democrats to win. And of course, Neil Gorsuch himself was one of the five justices who allowed Wisconsin to do that. So, you know, it's pretty outrageous to suggest that it's illegitimate for, you know, state courts to or federal courts to review state legislatures when they're not even electorally accountable. But yeah, this idea that the federal courts can sort of, you know, the argument is basically that, you know, there's language in the Constitution that says that, that state legislatures, set election law unless overridden by Congress. But the fact that power is given to a legislature in the first instance doesn't preempt judicial review. You know, no conservative would argue that the federal courts can't adjudicate Commerce Clause cases, even though those that power is given to Congress. And moreover, it's pretty hard to explain why state courts cannot interpret state election law, but federal courts can. You know, if only state legislatures could do it, why, you know, it's like, apparently there's no problem with federal courts interpreting state electoral law to determine, you know, what it means and to determine that one meaning is greater than the other. So it's a ridiculous argument. But then that's what matters, because honestly, it probably matters more going forward. You know, I want to reassure, you know, listeners to some extent, like, I don't think this is going to work. I don't think this election is going to be close enough, for these tactics to work. It's also very important that Democrats are in charge of the executive branch in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina. If some Trump judge orders like legitimate first counts to stop, they can just ignore them, and keep counting the ballots. So it's, you know, that's one crucial thing different from 2000. In 2000, you know, the Republican candidate's brother was literally in charge of the relevant government. This year it's going to be perhaps a little bit easier because Democrats are in charge of most of the key swing states. But, again, it's just because, and what I'm worried about now is that there's going to be this pivot to, vote suppression. You know, Biden won despite the vote suppression, so vote suppression isn't a big deal. Well, most elections are not, super high turnout presidential elections, with a pandemic and, that there are a lot of other elections where these tactics matter. And I'm also concerned that people will just kind of forget about Kavanaugh's behavior because it didn't work. But Democrats have to realize that, the idea that a court with Brett Kavanaugh as the median vote has any kind of legitimacy that's sacrosanct, and Republican Democrats cannot take any of their constitutionally authorized actions to reform the courts is just silly. As of next Tuesday, Democrats will have won the popular vote in seven of the last eight presidential elections. People have been appointed to the Supreme Court to impose an radically unpopular agenda on the country. Congress's ability to expand the courts is just as constitutional as Mitch McConnell's use of the advice and consent power to manipulate the personnel of the courts. So keep in mind that, even if it doesn't work, Brett Kavanaugh has just told you what he is, and the other justices may have been smart enough not to sign his opinion, but they don't disagree with him. And I think that's really, and I hope Democrats will keep that in mind. And I was very encouraged by the statement co-issued by Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar, pushing back hard on Kavanaugh's opinion, telling voters about that. That we have seen some, pretty moderate Democratic senators like Chris Kuhn, reacting very strongly. And so what I hope is that Kavanaugh's concurrence will end up actually being counterproductive by basically telling us the quiet parts loud.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that, because I was of the mind that that there may have been opportunities that were foregone to push the Amy Coney Barrett nomination or final vote into the lame duck. And I don't think there was any way to stop the vote, although doing it in the lame duck would have been much harder, which is why Mitch McConnell, I think, was very incentivized to push it there. But we are now in that realm, putting aside the election, presuming that the Supreme Court will not interfere in the election, which really is more going to be a function of the vote tally. And I am not as confident as you are that these things might be a little bit closer in certain states, but once burned, twice shy, I guess it is. But
no, and I understand. I'm saying excited.
Right. I mean, you know, I think if anything, the 2016 taught you was that, when someone has a 90% chance or an 85% chance or a 95% chance of doing something, well, 5% of the times, 10% of the time, 15% of the times, it doesn't happen. That's what that means. And you just more often than not think you're going to be in the 90 percentile as opposed to the 10 percentile. All right. With all that said, the next question is, having lost potentially control of the court for what could be decades, the question is, like, how do Democrats lose in such a way that fight to set up for the next fight? And let me get your assessment of this. I mean, you're not just a scholar of the law, but you're also a scholar of politics. And so give me your sense of, and you say to see Klobuchar and Sanders. And Sanders can be surprisingly institutionalist in the Senate,
right?
In the past. And I don't think people realize that. I think there's a perception that because of his politics, he is not. But I would put him, you know, in the median, if not in the institutionalist column, essentially. So to see Klobuchar and Sanders is very helpful. Give me your sense of, like, of just what are the opportunities to pack the court and what will it involve? Like, what do the Democrats, what do the left, what do, I don't know, the American public, what do they have to lose to function as a catalyst to expand the court?
Yeah, and I would like to see, the court expanded as part of a package, including statehood for D.C., offers of statehood to Puerto Rico, and so on. My guess is that, you know, there probably isn't going to be support for that at the beginning of the next Congress. And look, it took FDR, 4 years, with bigger congressional majorities to really, have a credible chance. I think the most likely scenario for expanding the court is, the court striking down, very popular legislation, and in a sense, so eliminating the filibuster is the same thing. Like, I think the filibuster is most likely to be eliminated because Republicans won't pass a $15 minimum wage or a COVID relief act, something along those lines. So I think the best way to help to create a catalyst for packing the courts is to try to pass as much popular legislation as you. So first of all, eliminate the filibuster, obviously. And basically, pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2021 and just dare the court to strike it down. The court will respond to the incentives and not strike it down, as ended up happening under FDR, or, they strike it down or mangle it, and you use that, retaliate against the courts.
Just to be clear, in terms of a timeline, I mean, you could be talking about a year or two, for that to wind its way through the system, right? Where you could vote to have a restoration of the Voting Rights Act and to perhaps include other things to shore up the rights to vote. But that may not be challenged for years.
Right. Yeah. Although, it's at least in the context of elections, it may be a challenge too early. So it could be something else. For example, the Supreme Court's going to be hearing a case about the Affordable Care Act in November. It may be hearing about the 15-week abortion ban in Mississippi. But having said that, it may not even require that. Again, that in a lot of times, you know, the Democratic leadership would have poo-pooed it. Nancy Pelosi, right after Barrett was confirmed, was on with Chris Hayes talking about how, you know, back when the 9 justice court was created, there were 9 circuits. There's now 13. I do think that we're seeing, you know, that just the, you know, the incredibly, you know, the incredibly rapid push to sort of cram Barrett onto the court, you know, does seem to have radicalized Democrats. And I agree with you that a lot of people don't understand that this is often a generational thing more than an ideological thing. You know, some of the most institutionally conservative Democrats in the past have been, you know, Russ Feingold and Pat Leahy, not conservative Democrats by any means. But often people who are in the Senate for a long time, you know, sort of have, you know, are attracted to these things. But that may also, you know, the upside of that may be that, you know, Kristen Sinema doesn't necessarily have anything vested in the filibuster. Joe Manchin may figure out that, you know, he has a lot more power with the 50-vote threshold than a 60-vote threshold. And similarly, I think that, you know, we may be able to sort of convince Democrats that, you know, we need to expand the courts to ensure that, you know, the reform measures that are passed get upheld. That's certainly what I hope, you know, but if that doesn't happen, then I think the plan B is get enough legislation in the pipeline that the courts basically have to do something about it before the next midterm. And incidentally, that's also a good reason for statehood for D.C. and potentially Puerto Rico, because the unlike in a lot of years, the Senate map in 2022 is actually quite favorable for Democrats. So if they're able to get the economy in better shape, recover from COVID, and particularly if you know the seats are added in D.C., you know they you know that you know this. Difference between a 4-year timeline and a 2-year timeline. If they don't have the support for expanding the courts right now, if they hold on to the Senate, you know, they can't just run out the clock. They're going to have to pass on right. some of this. So I think that we almost have to be thinking of all these things together. You know, I don't think that reform measures can be treated in isolation. You know, that ending the filibuster, you know, giving representation to D.C. and some other American territories, electoral reform, you know, all of these things, I think, go together. Doing any one of them makes it more likely that you can do the other things. So I think we have to take it as it goes. Maybe there's the support for doing this on day one. But if not, I think that we have to think of ways, to keep the options open, if we don't have the support right away. I'm not giving up. But I think that we need to think of ways that we can ensure that it can be done when it needs to be done.
Well, Scott, we will revisit this question after the election, and hopefully the outcome of the election will be such that this question of what will maintain the energy or increase the energy or maintain the pressure on Democratic senators to get rid of the filibuster and to pass aggressive laws providing for voting rights and hopefully material benefits for people such that it will provoke this fight and perhaps a response from the Democrats that I hope that we can reconvene and that will not be a hypothetical conversation, but will be one that that we can track in real time. Scott Lemieux, as always, a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sam. And again, hopefully we will be talking under better circumstances next time.
Knock on wood. Scott Lemieux is a professor of political science at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, with a focus on the Supreme Court and constitutional law. He's a frequent contributor to the American Prospect and blogs for Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Folks, don't need to tell you how important voting is in this election. You've got a couple of days to get there if you're doing early voting. If you have an absentee ballot, best at this point to deliver it in person. It will not make it there if you mail it. This, of course, is one of the, well, I don't know. We say this all the time about it, the most important election of a lifetime. But in many respects, I'm getting up there in age. I think this is the one. Anyhow, that's it for another week of Ring of Fire. I want to thank you, all of you, of our free subscribers who this week decided to make the plunge and support the program by becoming members. And if you want to do the same, help the show out, head over to ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringofireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream at noon and then later as a podcast. Also, if you want your headline news in the morning, 6 or 7 minutes, as soon as you wake up, AM Quickie. You can find it at amquickie.com. I'm Sam Cedar, and this has been Ring of Fire.
Sound of drums. People couldn't believe what I've become.